Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where today we're asking poetry? What poetry? Does poetry need fixing? Does it need saving? What's the state of pentameter and rhyme and stanzas and rhythm and meter? Who's reading? Who's listening? Who's writing? We'll try and tell you in the next 29 minutes. Personally, I think it's a shame that people think it's a dark and dusty and slightly scary part of the public lending library of cultural life. So let's see, shall we? Poetry, what poetry? With me, Robert Bound, right about now. My first guest today is a novelist and a poet. He wrote the novel Submarine that was turned into a film by Richard Ayoade back in 2010, but he's written plenty more besides, of course. His poetry has been published by esteemed titles like The New Statesman and the London Review of Books, and he was published as one of Faber's Young Poets in 2010. He is Joe Dunthorne, and he is with me now. Joe, thanks for popping into the studio.
Pleasure.
On this beautiful hot day. We've discussed that at length before we switched on the microphone.
So we have.
Let's get that out of the way.
We're both in shorts.
And we are both in shorts. Let's just lay that out there for the listener and let them make of it what we will. Now, I wanted to ask you first, Joe, we're taking the temperature of poetry slightly on this programme today, and I wonder why you think that is always asked. You know, it's National Poetry Day. There's always occasions that are invented to boost the status of poetry somehow.
I know.
Do you think it needs all this stuff?
Well, it's a funny thing, isn't it? It feels like it comes in a kind of 18-month cycle. Right. The kind of, is poetry having its moment? I guess no, it isn't. Is normally the bottom line.
Yeah.
I guess it being like a niche art form that was once the art form, or
yeah,
at least one of the dominant art forms. There's always this question of, will it ever get back to what it was? Will we have Wordsworth as the rock star poet again? And I guess the answer is no. That's not likely to happen. But it does seem to be having a bit of a moment.
So there are different ways, I suppose, of enjoying it. There is buying the book of poetry, and there is reading it on the tube and when you get home and all the rest of it. Then there's the poet reading it out. You read your own work beautifully.
Mm.
What is the best way to take your poetry medicine, I wonder?
That's a good question. I think it, predictably, it's really about taste.
Yeah.
I know lots of people completely commit to reading it on the page and think anything else is a dilution, and lots of people feel the opposite, and they want that connection, like eye contact almost, with the poet on the stage. And there's a kind of artistry, slightly separate artistry, to performing your poems on stage. So I think whatever works for you. I know lots of people who commit to either one or the other.
Okay. There's a strange sense of, if you're at the Hay Festival, for example, and you're reading a few of your poems out from a new collection, then that's a bit of, you know, for the audience, and they are an audience, then they're readers first, but then they become an audience. There's a strange dislocation, perhaps, from the way that you wrote the poem and the reason you wrote the poem and kind of what that poem means, and then you realising that you've got an audience. If you're performing a poem about heartbreak and then suddenly you're doing it to 250 people, does that become something different for you, I wonder?
I think that can be quite strange. And generally, especially if it's a poem about heartbreak, you know, a really personal poem, there is quite an unsettling thing of standing in front of people and getting applause for it. Because I guess often those poems come from some other kind of motivation. You had to write them.
Yeah.
I know that when I'm writing poems, I think of poems that I am more comfortable reading on stage and more happy to be published and just to know that someone's having a kind of private reading moment with that poem, as opposed to this public thing of like maybe making people laugh or trying to be liked or whatever it is, which I enjoy too. I love reading and trying to be liked. but I think they're quite different things.
And you mentioned motivation. Let's talk about that and about inspiration and about the idea, the genesis of some of your poems, whether they are something that you're interested in, a comment that needs to be made about the world or that you'd like to make, or simply the sound of something good, you know, a kind of phrase that keeps banging around like a pinball in your head, I wonder.
It's very much the latter for me. I'm normally led by a phrase, or even simply by putting the pen to the page and seeing what comes out. And I tend to produce a lot in a free sort of way, with the idea that I'll just pluck out the ideas that I like and kind of shape them up. I would certainly never respond to a kind of public event in the Poet Laureate. I guess that's the curse of the Poet Laureate. You're forced to do something that most poets find horrible and respond to some news story.
Sort of an editorial, a comment piece in the form of a poem, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Which I think most poets just find, well, A, very difficult, and B, unpleasant. So I guess I might respond to something that's going on in my life, but normally I'm just led by having fun with language and trying to make something that feels memorable on its own terms.
First of all, does this go down in a note a little notebook in your pocket? Is it one phrase, one thing that you've lifted from a bathroom wall?
Yeah.
or an advertising slogan that seems to be particularly meaningful or particularly meaningless or particularly strange?
Yeah. No, completely. Or overheard things. You know, yeah. I write down lots of dialogue I might hear, or well, that's quite a fun thing, which probably everyone does. You see someone on the tube or see someone in the street and you just try and imagine their life or something about them. I remember seeing a young woman carrying a bank safe upstairs, and that just seemed an interesting start for a poem. Or a guy on crutches I saw in the hairdressers the other day, who seemed, he was telling the story of why he was on crutches, which was just that he'd fallen in the shower. But the way he was so interestingly dressed, it seemed such a mundane story for why he'd broken his ankle or whatever, that I created a much more interesting version of why he was on crutches as a poem.
That's a great kickoff, right? Sort of a man dressed as a circus ringmaster, having his beard trimmed in a barber shop sort of thing.
And talking about his boring life. And I thought, no, you need to have a much more interesting life than the one you have.
Yeah, exactly. How dare you tell me you're a loss adjuster? When you write, is the first thought the best thought? Is there a lot of editing? Do you kind of roll with it for sort of 12 lines, 20 lines, and do a little bit of editing? Maybe it's different on different days. Who knows?
Yeah, it is. I think maybe, I'm going to say twice a year, it's a one draft, first thought, best thought moment, which is amazing and rare. And the rest of the time, it's mostly 20 drafts, which can be more grueling. I've got poems that are still not right, and maybe I should have given up on them. But, you know, after 20 drafts, you're like, well, I have to keep going because I've done so much work.
Yeah, right. With that much squeezing, the nut will crack.
Yeah, eventually. But in the end, it's just this dry husk of a poem that you know, all life is squeezed out of it.
And as I mentioned in the intro, people will know your work from Submarine, and you have a new novel, Adulterance, which is coming out at the beginning of next year, I think.
Yeah, February.
So I guess the obvious question is, what's the difference between the two? How do you know that something's going to become a novel and then something's going to become a poem?
It's interesting. Sometimes I can't tell, and I'll write something as a short story and realise it should be a novel, or something as a short story and realise it should be a poem, or between all the genres, sometimes they move. Mostly, I guess it's prosaic. It's the size of the story. I mean, poems...
Something has a great sweep. It is not an eight-line little...
Right. A poem can be about me sipping my glass of water, and a novel can't be, or unless you're extremely Joycean, it can't be. So, yeah, there's that. But I tend to kind of find out in the writing. I guess it's some moments feel right for stories and some for poems.
And as I say, is it something like the arc of something? I mean, there is something difficult actually about knowing how a story ends. You know what you want to say in this thing. You've got two great lines that maybe the beginning and the end of something, and you just need to get there, which can be a poem. Not to put any less weight of importance majesty and work into it, but you know what I mean? Is a story simply something else where you kind of know what's going to happen to the end, but you know that there can be a lot of adventure had on the way to getting there?
Yeah, that's interesting. And when I'm writing a novel, sometimes I'm in the position of not knowing how to move the story forward. And in fact, I sometimes bring in what I think of as like my fifth gear, the kind of poetry gear. It's like, basically, you can kind of cheat. It's a bit like that bit in a musical when, you know, they're trying to convince someone to go to the dangerous place, the dangerous woods, and the person doesn't want to go. And they sing a song, and by the end of the song, the person's convinced and they're on the way to the dangerous woods. So in a novel, I sometimes go, okay, let's just hit the poetry button for a while, and suddenly something magical, alchemical has happened and my characters feel differently. So I sometimes think poetry, even though it feels a bit like cheating, has this magic thing where you can kind of
away with things. It unlocks the brain. And
right.
It sort of gets, and it's kind of, you know, it's spraying some oil in the engine or something.
You're exactly.
Well, I know how to do this. I know how, this is feeling good. This is kind of doing it.
Yeah.
Is it about confidence as well? Is it? I mean, where does confidence play into all of it? I wonder.
Yeah, there's definitely, I think the oil in the engine metaphor is quite good, because I find poetry very much a muscle that you have to keep stretching. And when I'm writing poetry, I tend to write lots, and maybe would write two poems a day or three poems a day at a stretch for maybe 3 months. And I notice it becomes a lot easier, but also ended up in stranger places, because I kind of cover the most obvious ground early on, and then you run out of the obvious ideas and you start going to stranger places, which is what I want from my poetry anyway. So I tend to do it in a big, very energetic block.
I've just read before I came down The Actual Queen, your wonderful poem, The Actual Queen. And I thought, what a lovely idea for a poem that is, to find one little glinting kind of idea of what she might feel like on one particular moment, on one particular day. It's a sort of almost a universal idea of, it's almost the dream of having tea with a queen or something similar. If this is a muscle that needs to be exercised, the poetry muscle, are there a few subjects that for you can always hit pay dirt kind of thing? They're always reliable, I wonder. You know what I mean? If you're kind of like, well, I know if I'm a runner, I can do the jog around the park kind of nice. And that's right. Writing about...
What's my safe...
My bank account or something, you know. And but you know you can get something out of it just to exercise.
That's a good question. I think my kind of go-to tone when I'm feeling like every poet's looking for their own bit of turf that feels like their own thing.
Yeah.
And one thing poets often aren't is egotistical and arrogant, at least in their poetry. So I find it quite fun to play with that as a tone, because it doesn't feel like there's lots of poets being very compassionate and there's lots of poets being very thoughtful, and there aren't that many poets. There is one, Frederick Seidel, notably, who is a kind of maniac, but it,
a kind of maniac.
I quite like playing with that.
Yeah.
So I guess if I was saying that's my kind of safe zone, being a
sort of a bolshy, arrogant
being
poet,
a kind of money
not the
obsessed
register. Yeah.
Yes, a kind of disgusting human is my go-to tone.
And finally, what did you write today? Did you write anything? No pressure.
I'm just editing my novel, so I've been slaving over proofs of this new novel. Not creating anything new, creating some things new in between existing lines. No poetry.
And what's that like? I mean, that's when poetry is such a sparing and kind of laser beam focused way of writing. Editing is kind of, you know, the art of taking away. I suppose there's poetry in that, right? It's taking all the fat off.
Definitely, and I feel those skills are completely compatible. This novel I've written just got smaller and smaller and smaller. But 2 years ago, it was maybe 85,000, and now I'm just trying to keep it above 50,000 words, because that feels like when you get below 50,000, it stops being a novel. And maybe that's slightly the poet's curse, that you end up just, your instinct, at least my instinct, is just to chop and chop and chop. It's certainly a useful skill. The poet's, I guess, gaze on a sentence and on a word level can be very useful.
Power to it. More novels, I think, from
right,
poets.
Right, I do sometimes think that.
Joe Dunthorne, thank you so much. We should push people in the direction of The Adulterants, although it's spring 2018.
Yeah, February 2018.
Is that for Faber as well?
It's Hamish Hamilton Penguin.
Uh-huh. Joe Dunthorne, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's look at how poetry travels. The Enemies Project is an outfit that promotes poetry through collaboration, whether across the arts, countries, or languages. Across the globe, over 500 poets, artists, photographers, and musicians have participated in their events in dozens of countries, so they're well-versed in how the medium travels and the places that take to it the most. Producer Holly met the Enemies Project's curator and poet, S.J. Fowler.
Oh, look, they're reenacting the birth of Charles.
No.
That's adorable. What a woman. The skin of a hot water bottle.
I actually came to poetry much later in my life than most of my peers involved in literature in general. I was doing something radically different. I was doing martial arts for a living. And then I had a massive car crash, which meant I couldn't do professional athletics anymore. And I discovered poetry then by accident. So I found it in my mid-20s, and that undoubtedly has shaped the way I engage with it, because I'm hungry to catch up with everyone who's been doing it much longer than me.
And you are the curator for the Enemies Project. How did you get involved with that?
I began it in 2010 because I'd been invited very early in my writing career to read at a few festivals abroad. And I'd gone and I'd realised that all the European or even global poets that we knew in the UK were these massive monolithic post-war figures who were dead or about to die, and all greying men. And I realised going to these festivals in Iceland and Romania and these different places that actually there was an incredible new generation of European poets. So by accident, I agreed to put on a reading in London to host some of the poets who'd invited me, just out of hospitality, really, kind of reluctantly, I have to be honest. And it was a disaster. No one came to see European poets on a Thursday evening. So I realised the next time that happened, again, very organically, that by getting them to collaborate with British poets and create new work, not only would I get a bigger audience, but I would also give them a much richer communal experience based in the relationships they built. And within a year of that, it had become, again, rather reluctantly from my aims, successful enough that I could apply for funding. And now we've done, nearly 700 events in 22 countries with over 1,000 poets. So it has a life of its own.
So give us an idea about what some of these collaborations are or can be.
Yeah, I think that, again, one of the great misnomers about poetry is this rarefied golden nugget that a poet produces that can't be touched. But in fact, every time someone writes a poem, it's just a response to language in the world. It's just a manipulation of the thing we use to communicate for a purpose that's not communication. So when you're collaborating, the inspiration is simply another human being. So I often just randomly pair poets from different countries with different languages and different styles, and they get on fantastically as long as they have a human connection. So we've done tours, we do these events called Camarada, where I pair poets who might know each other but often don't. And really the only criteria is that I don't give them much time. They have to perform within 5 to 7 to 10 minutes. And I normally have up to 20 poets at an event. So it's this massive, communal, warm-hearted, intensive experimental experience, and people respond really well to that.
And language is an interesting one, because obviously all these poets would be writing, working in different languages. How does that then come together? And also, how does an audience react to listening to something in a language they don't understand? Because then it all falls on rhyme and rhythm as well.
For sure. Well, there's lots of different elements to that question, I think. The first is that inevitably English is a lingua franca, it's a dominant language, and inevitably poets tend to be from middle class or up. So everyone speaks fantastic English, and even when I ask them, please read in your native language, they tend to resist that and want to be in English. This is one of the profound things about the UK scene that nobody really thinks about, but no UK poet cares about getting translated, because English is their dominant, their passport. But in most other nations, getting a good translator into English is a major step in their career. So in a way, it's something they want to do, to work in English. So that inevitably tends to happen in England. Outside of that, I always ask them if they're reading or writing or collaborating in another language to not put translations up. That people have to live with it, to actually listen to the actual cadence of the language, even if they don't understand the semantic content. And I really urge people to do that. So often, because the time slots are quite short, people don't get impatient. They actually love listening to those languages, and also the change in body language from a poet who's been speaking in their second language, English, then into their native language is fascinating itself.
Gadałam do niego czula, mówiąc, kamieniu mięsa, kamieniu mięsa, kamieniu mięsa.
The UK is kind of lagging behind other countries with their poetry. Do you think this is all to do with how we are taught it? Because I think a lot of people see it as that thing they had to learn in school, that they see it as maybe a slightly highbrow art form. How do you think we should tackle that?
Definitely. I think this is the major issue of our present day in poetry in the UK. And it's really, really complex and it's multifaceted. I teach at the moment. I don't have a PhD, but I was very lucky to get a job teaching in a university. And most of my students are from a working class background. And the reality is that I say to them that the big lie that they've been given is nobody challenging the actual function of them enjoying or learning poetry, and letting people think that it's above them, letting them think it's too complex for them. But when I ask them if they have something that they're passionate about, how did their taste develop? It was just time. It wasn't experience. It wasn't any of these things that people associate with poetry traditionally, which has to do with class and England's past. It's just time. And what we've done is we've tried to look at poetry as though it's something that will give immediate gratification, and it simply doesn't. And the poetry industry has tried to lean into that by making poetry simpler and simpler, and created these paradoxes like National Poetry Day, where they'll say poetry is innately good for you. If you read poetry, you'll be better as a human being. And now here's the poem we're going to give you. It's really easy to understand. Well, it just doesn't make sense psychologically. I'm really happy when people say they don't like poetry and they have no interest in it, and I don't want to change their mind. It's not my mission as a poet to try and convince the world it's valuable. There's enough people who know it's valuable, and it's only valuable when it is complex and challenging and it does make you grow and it does engage with you. And the problem is that in schools, no one has really tried to interrogate the reality of what that is, because when I read poetry at school, I hated it. And I didn't come to poetry till 10 years later, till I found it on my own. So it's not for me to say to people, poetry will change your life, it'll make you better.
Do you find that when you go to these different countries that people have a different relationship with poetry? Do you find there's, you know, bigger and smaller crowds at different places you go?
Definitely. And every country's different. But I always use the example of, say, Austria. I've gone to Austria and done my strangest works, which are very strange. And no one thinks it's unusual. And I have to, and Germany too, and France too, and beyond that, in different parts of the world, in Mexico, even in places like I did a reading in Iraq, and I did strange work, and people were sensitive to it. It's not just for the reason that everyone thinks, which is poetry's had a more important place in those nations because of different economic or historical or creative reasons. It's also to do with history and politics. So Austria, their post-war literature was about interrogating Anschluss, the myth that they didn't want to unify with Nazi Germany. It's about guilt. And so language that was used to buoy up this fascist lie needs to be interrogated. People have to say, look at the great post-war German poets. Who are they? They're Celan, they're Brecht, you know, these experimental poets. Look at the British. They're like the empire dudes still. They're brilliant poets, but the Larkins and the Ted Hughes and the Audens, they're just in the same model as they were before the war. But in Austria, they're completely different. And so when I turn up and do something weird, they're like, yeah, that's what poetry is now. It's changed. Of course it's changed. It's like comparing figurative landscape painting to modern art. If you did that in the UK, if you could only win the Turner Prize by painting a field, people would laugh at you. But poetry is at the point now where you better still be painting a field or you'll never be nominated for a prize or supported. And that incredible lagging behind of contemporary thought and ideas and technology, which poetry is such a bizarre example of, just doesn't exist in other nations.
And you said at the beginning of this that your first European Poetry Night, you got no one there. We've got plenty more coming up. What's changed between then and now?
I do think that things like Brexit have kind of helped what I do, because obviously my outlook ethically and emotionally and culturally is international and especially European. And I think there's a huge push in London, especially, against those kind of sentiments that don't represent people's feelings, that want to engage in international work, collaborative work and experimental work. So I think increasingly as the internet's become, you know, so just fundamental to everyone's lives and these political things have happened, there's a blowback to stuff that's a bit more left-leaning, shall we say. Maybe not politically, but culturally. So that's definitely helped what I do, because a lot of the stuff I do is really challenging and really strange and very much in that European tradition. And I think people are slowly getting more of a palate for that. But it's almost impossible to say, actually. Who knows?
It all started when I translated the Kapuradai Stotra, the hymn to the goddess Kali. A tantric text, yes, tantra as in sting. Yes, tantra as...
That was S.J. Fowler, curator of the Enemies Project. And to find out more about their events, head to theenemiesproject.com. Over to Singapore we head now to end the show, where the crown jewel of the country's literary scene is poetry. Since independence, poets have been grappling with the island's national identity through verse on the page. Today, stacks of poetry books tower over novels and non-fiction in the Lion City's bookshops, while everyone from hipsters to office drones pack into crowded cafes have a listen to what spoken word poets are selling. Monocle's Megan Gibson talks to the people and poets fueling the craze.
In bars and cafes across Singapore, groups of literary-minded men and women gather to drink, laugh, and listen to poetry.
Fields and fields of alien crops that rose and twirled. Why plant the seed if you cannot see it flower?
Singapore's poetry scene is booming, with regular public readings, slam events taking place, and a steady stream of new books being released. From seasoned pros sharing their work to amateurs dabbling at open mic nights, the island nation of 5.5 million has never offered more options when it comes to enjoying verse.
I first came to spoken word, I want to say maybe around 2002, 2003, when I wandered into a poetry slam.
That's Pooja Nancy, a prominent poet here, and the author of books such as Love is an Empty Bar Stool. She's also Singapore's youth poet ambassador and a champion of the spoken word scene.
It's actually quite gratifying, right, to have someone respond to your work. It becomes kind of a theatre space. And I think since then, like, a lot of the younger spoken word poets have grown in the scene and started their own sort of events. So it's really burgeoning, I think.
Prashant Samasundram is a co-founder of Artistry, one of the numerous cafes and galleries that now regularly holds poetry events. Each month, poetry fans fill the Airy Cafe for an event called Speakeasy. Here, they listen to the work of various poets, including those who are visiting from abroad. Prashant says Speakeasy has become increasingly popular.
But when you turn in the wrong direction, you're always in the middle of a prison.
I've seen it actually grow quite a bit. And I think it's because people are breaking away from the structured form of poetry. And you know, the poets are keeping a very fun attitude towards. So in terms of the presentation of poetry to an audience that is not really, you know, interested in literary aspects, it transcends those boundaries and it reaches out to a lot more customers than we've seen before. Poetry is meant to be heard also, rather than just read from a book. So, you know, to me, this really allows people to see it in a different light.
But while poetry is having something of a moment in the Lion City, its popularity has roots in the nation's founding.
I think for us, poetry has always been a stronghold. And I think various factors came together naturally.
That's Kenny Lueck, the owner of a bookshop called Books Actually and a publishing press called Math Paper Press, which prints numerous poetry books. For Singaporean writers, poetry offers a freedom of expression because, unlike fiction, it is less likely to be censored by the state. Perhaps it's harder to crack down on metaphors and similes. That doesn't mean that the government hasn't been wary of poetry in the past. Kenny tells me about a speech given by Singapore's founding Prime Minister, Loo Kuan Yew, shortly after independence in 1968. Speaking at a university, he uttered the now infamous line, "Poetry is a luxury we cannot afford."
We are such a puny, puny little country that we are, of course, wedged in between geopolitical factors. We are this secular country in the midst of all other bigger countries. LKY's idea was that, you know, to make people work, make people save money, you just focus on the economics.
That focus on the economy has no doubt benefited the tiny nation. It's one of the wealthiest states in the region. But quelling the arts and poets' pens couldn't last long.
I think there's no longer this negative feelings about it, because currently it seems like we could afford everything else. Once we have satisfied our basic needs, which is we have food on the table, we have shelter over our heads, what's the next thing that we want? You know, we are looking at things that would give us pleasure. Film, music, well, writing, books, the arts.
Yet, for all the popularity that poetry is enjoying here, Kenny believes that the literary scene in Singapore is still too rarefied. He says that academic and literary circles could, and should, be even more democratic.
The whole idea of arts is not just for a selected group of people. I mean, from London to Bangkok to China, arts is for everybody to enjoy because the arts is meant to inspire, right? But how often do we ask ourselves that the arts that we're putting out, the people that we are marketing to, right, via Facebook, via Instagram, how often are we just talking to the same group of people? What is our growth numbers? Are we really reaching out to the masses?
This is something that even the state has started to reckon with. This year, the National Arts Council has, for the first time, named a youth poet ambassador, our friend, Pooja Nancy.
It's a program started by the National Arts Council in order to promote the awareness of poetry amongst youth or amongst groups of people who may not naturally come to poetry, whether in school or in a reading culture in their home. The affectionate term for Singaporean lit is singlit, and a lot of people felt that we had a phenomenal number of writers writing, and somehow that wasn't translating into readership. There's been a real kind of ground-up effort to kind of just, you know, raise the awareness of Singaporean writing and Singaporean narratives.
See, me keeping in tune is like finding the goal at the end of a rainbow. You're always searching for it, always keeping your back behind to the rain, looking out front.
If it's true that poetry hasn't quite reached the masses yet, it's also true that the young nation, and even younger literary scene, has made impressive strides. With the collective effort of everyone, from publishers to bookshop owners and writers, to promote verse, poetry's popularity can only continue. For Monocle in Singapore, I'm Megan Gibson.
So poetry, what poetry? Maybe we should just take the thermometer out of the patient's mouth and tell it it's fine. Why do we always fret so? There's a lot of funny and a lot of necessary in contemporary poetry, as we've heard. Write one yourself, why don't you? Just don't make it about your ex or your cat, okay? And that brings us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Culture, where my producer was the 21st Century Wordsworth Holly Fisher. Join me again at the same time next week, but for the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and thanks for tuning in.